Welcome back to Cloak & Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom. Once again, we're here at Cloak & Dagger to expose the state secrets that the ruling elite hope you don't learn and to scrape the bullshit off the truth. Joining me on the line is none other than Ralph Schoenman. Ralph, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you back here at Cloak & Dagger.
Thank you, Lenny. Good to be with you.
Ralph, once again with our weekly briefing, there's a lot going on, missiles in Korea and all sorts of provocations in Gaza. Why don't you just take it away and theme us in on what's on your geopolitical radar today?
Well, we've been discussing last week, Lenny, the situation in Gaza. I mean, there, as I mentioned, the Israelis in conjunction with the United States, when the Israeli Prime Minister had visited Washington, he conferred with Bush about a plan, and the plan is to escalate the war against Syria and Iran, and that required initiating something in Palestine. The Israelis began a series of targeted assassinations, and targeting in particular random civilian populations in Gaza and the West Bank, and particularly in the beaches of Gaza, they slaughtered whole families while they were on the beaches, four separate occasions, and finally succeeded in provoking a response, an overdue response. And as I mentioned, it was through a tunnel that had been dug from Gaza into so-called Israel proper, but which had been monitored by the Shin Bet. And that has been the pretext for the kidnapping of an Israeli soldier. It has been the pretext for an operation that had been planned for months in advance. And the scale of this operation in Gaza and the West Bank, as we've described, is nothing short of an assault on the entire population. They've destroyed the entire infrastructure, the power plant throughout Gaza, so there's no water or electricity available to the civilian population in the searing summer temperatures, is, as the UN called it, a humanitarian disaster. And that's being escalated, and they have announced they're going to assassinate the Palestinian Prime Minister. They've kidnapped 54 members of the Palestinian Parliament, 20 members of the Palestinian Authority Cabinet, and they've said that they will target any official for assassination based upon one soldier's kidnapping. And in fact, the Prime Minister of Israel declared that the life of one Israeli is worth more than any number of Palestinians in a formal statement, which is appropriate for this murder state, because Israel is nothing but a colonial settler state on the model of South Africa that targets the entire Palestinian population for elimination. That's been its premise from its inception. The Zionist state was fostered and born in the premise that the European Jews should become colonists afar. This was in the late 19th century. Upper bourgeois figures who were frightened of the radicalization amongst the ghettoized, impoverished, and persecuted Jewish ghetto dwellers of Eastern and Central Europe, who were joining the revolutionary parties and were profoundly alienated from the repressive and reactionary and anti-Semitic regimes of the day.
Ralph, can I just interrupt you and ask a few questions that come to my mind as I hear you talk about this?
Sure.
Are you saying that Israel is very much like South Africa in that respect? You're making a comparison between them?
It's worse.
Are you basically implying also that therefore, can I draw the conclusion improperly or improperly that therefore are the blacks in South Africa the same as the Jews in Israel then? Are they really Are you saying that they're not really in control of the country? It's not a Jewish state?
No, I don't understand that, Lenny.
Well, okay, let me back up.
I'm saying is this, the Zionist movement was a response of the Jewish bourgeoisie to the radicalization of the masses amongst Jews in Europe.
Yes.
And they instead of joining with Jews and other oppressed people, exploited people, to challenge the feudal and reactionary regimes of the day, like that of the Tsar of Russia, or the Kaiser in Germany, or the feudal regimes in Eastern Europe, instead of doing that, they made common cause with the most reactionary and anti-Semitic governments of that time. The founders of Zionism, Theodor Herzl and Chaim Weizmann, contacted the Tsar and the leader of the pogroms, Count von Plehve, who had organized the great pogrom at Kishinev and the Black Hundreds, and they said, you arm us and you finance us and we'll get rid of your subversive, unruly, uncontrollable Jews. We'll make them into colonists and we'll occupy Palestine as your commercial and military instrument to further Tsarist interests in the area. They also made the same approach to the Kaiser, and they made the same approach to the British Raj, and they made the same approach to Mussolini, and they made the same approach to French imperialism, French colonialism. And the Zionist movement put forward the thesis that this was a land without a people for a people without a land. And their objective was not merely to colonize Palestine, which is what, after all, the European powers had done in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where they sought to obtain cheap labor and the natural resources of the area by colonizing those areas. But the Zionist project had a fundamental difference in that they were not interested in cheap labor. They were interested in removing the indigenous population and creating a settler workforce in its place. This had a genocidal intent,
uh-huh,
rather like what was done to the Native Americans in North America. In North America, the Native Americans were targeted for elimination,
right,
for their displacement by a settler population, and that's the project in Palestine.
Uh-huh.
And every single colonial undertaking in Palestine has its objective the removal of the Palestinians from the land and the seizure of their land and their armed displacement. Everybody understands the difference between immigrating to a place and colonizing it. And to obtain this, secure this objective, the Zionist movement modeled itself on Cecil B. Rhodes, the colonizing movement in South Africa,
right,
and in the Rhodesias. And in fact, throughout the period of colonization, they were engaged in armed assaults upon the Palestinians to eliminate and remove them and to seize their land. The attempt by the Rothschilds to purchase land from absentee Turkish landlords over the heads of the Palestinian fellaheen or peasantry,
uh-huh,
was largely unsuccessful. They only obtained roughly 1%, some say 3%, of the land by purchasing it from the absentee landlords and then removing the Palestinian farmers or peasants from the absentee landlord land. In spite of their backing from the Tsar and the Kaiser and then British and French imperialism, and they're being trained by the British colonial armies as shock troops against the Palestinian population, they were only able to, over 75 years, bring settlers to a point where they were approximately 28% of the population at the time in 1947, when the Jewish Agency got the backing of Stalin and Truman to form a colony over the heads of the Palestinian people. And they, at the United Nations in 1947, when the Jewish Agency went before the Special Committee of the United Nations on Palestine, the head of the Jewish Agency who made the presentation to the United Nations, Rabbi Fishman, based himself on the second volume of Theodor Herzl's diary, and he presented a map, which is a map that was actually drawn up in 1903 in the second volume of Herzl's diary, and the map is of what is called Eretz Israel, or the Land of Israel. The Land of Israel, according to the official position of the Jewish Agency and the Zionist settler movement, the Land of Israel was all of Palestine, all of Jordan, one-third of Arabia, Egypt up to the Nile, including Cairo, two-thirds of Syria, one-half of Iraq, the southern tier of Turkey, and Kuwait. That's Eretz Israel.
Yes.
And when the UN partitioned Palestine without any input from the Palestinians and gave 55% of the most fertile land to the Zionist settlers, the settler movement, the Zionist movement, and its military, its armed military bands, the Haganah and the Palmach and the Irgun, began a series of massacres of ethnic cleansing from one end of Palestine to the other. They literally butchered all the inhabitants of village after village and town after town from one part of the country to the other until they succeeded in driving out 830,000 people out of a population of about 960,000. Now they had seized 93% of the land, and they found themselves, they were now in control of 475 Palestinian towns and villages in this empty land where there was no people. And they, what they did was they razed to the ground 385 towns and villages. They wiped them off the map. Of the remaining 90 towns and villages, they seized all the land. And now, at the time of the formation of the Israeli state, the Jewish Agency's legislation was adopted by the state that requires anybody to who wants to work, own land, lease land, work land, or to be employed on land, to prove four generations of maternal Jewish descent. In essence, suppose that in North America, to be entitled to live on land or to own property or to work it or to sharecrop it, you had to prove you had no Jewish blood for at least four generations. No maternal Jewish blood, less, for at least four generations. Everybody would understand the essentially racist nature of such a proposition, and the state is a state of a racist exclusion. It writes the Palestinians out of their own history. So the entire predicate of the Zionist colony in Palestine, the Israeli state, is that the inhabitants of that place have no rights whatsoever, and that the project in Palestine from its inception has been to eliminate the Palestinians, physically to remove them, and to seize all their land and their property. In fact, the formation of the Israeli state was based upon the seizure of all of the olive groves and the quarries and the citrus groves and all of the productive forces in that society of the entire area of the state of Israel. Only 67,000 acres were state domain. The rest was taken over, and 80% of the land was immediately seized from the Palestinian population. The value of this stolen property, and that's now about 50 years ago, at that time was about $1 billion. The Arab League estimates, those are the official estimates, the Arab League estimates were 10 times higher than that amount. The UN Refugee Office estimated the value of Palestinian orchards, trees, movable and immovable property at that time as about 500 million pounds sterling. The seizure of Palestinian property was indispensable to making Israel a viable state. Between 1948 and 1953, 370 Jewish towns and settlements were established on what was called absentee or stolen property. In fact, by 1954, something like 55% of Israel's Jews lived on property immediately confiscated from the Palestinians, and 250,000 immigrants were settled in urban areas from which the Palestinians had been expelled. The entire cities had been emptied of Palestinians by their being forced marched out, executed, and physically removed. Jaffa, Acca, Lida, Ramla, Bassan, Majdal. The plunderers I mentioned embraced 385 towns and villages in their entirety, and large sections of 94 other cities and towns containing 45% of all the buildings in Israel. 20,000 business and retail stores were handed over to Jewish settlers. And indeed, from 48 to 53, which is the period of the greatest colonizing and immigration, the economic importance to Israel of the seized Arab property was decisive. The amount of cultivatable land seized from the Palestinians, driven from the country by massacre, was 3.5 times the total area of land granted the Zionists at the end of the mandate. All the citrus groves of Palestine were seized. That's more than 150,000 acres. 1.25 million boxes of citrus were seized from Arab groves and were put into Israeli hands. 20% of the country's hard currency profits came from Palestinian export. By 51, 95% of Israel's olive groves were seized from the Palestinians. Olive produce stolen from Palestinian groves represented Israel's third largest export after citrus and diamonds. One-third of all stone production came from the 52 seized Palestinian quarries. Well, you know the mythology. Zionist industry and dedication and skill transformed the barren desert neglected by its primitive nomadic custodians who had only recently descended from the trees, making the desert bloom. Yeah, they made the desert bloom. Palestinian orchards, industry, rolling stock, factories, houses, possessions, shops, pillaged after slaughtering conquest. So this ship of state is a vessel of pirates, and the proper flag is a skull and crossbones. That's the basic character of this state, and from its inception, the project of the Israeli state, which is basically an advanced shock force of American imperialism in the region, that's why the U.S. has funded the Zionist state with $100 billion since 48, and that's the official number.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't include the loans, which never get repaid. The state of California puts its funds into banks that the Zionists control, and where they only have to pay 1 or 2% interest, as opposed to what the normal rate is. It's a form of subsidizing the state. Many of the U.S. states are obligated to do that. The only country in the world to which so-called aid doesn't have to be paid is the Israeli state. The only country in the world where the condition of obtaining aid is that they have to then use some of that to buy U.S. produce. No, that's the Zionists are accepted from that. This is simply an enforcement arm of U.S. imperialism in the region, and its basic thrust is to engage other Arab states that are militarily far weaker in conflict, then to attack, seize the land, expel the population, and expand colonial control. From its inception, that's been the character of this state. So the obvious response from people who defend the right of self-determination or the right of the oppressed, anybody who is supportive of the anti-colonial struggle, the Zionist state should not be excluded from these demands. What did we say when it came to the colonization of South Africa. Bear in mind that South Africa was colonized in the 16th century, not in the 20th century, in the 16th century. And indeed, the settlers in South Africa had lived in South Africa for 400 years. But everybody understood that it's one thing to be a citizen of a country, and it's another to colonize it and to seize the property and the labor rights of its indigenous inhabitants and to enslave them. So the demand was to the elimination of an apartheid state. Nobody said to the South Africans that to be entitled to self-determination, first there had to be an exclusive white settler state in Johannesburg and in Cape Town and in Durban and in Pretoria. No one said in southern Rhodesia that for the Africans to be right to have the right to their self-determination, first they had to secure an exclusive white state in Harare, Salisbury. Nobody said that in Zambia, northern Rhodesia, they had to have a white exclusive settler state in Ndola and in Lusaka and in Kitwe before the people were entitled to assert their right to their own country. No, the demand was that the colonial settler regime was illegitimate and should be overthrown and removed. If the white settlers want to be citizens of the country, if any Jews who have emigrated or to Palestine or gone there as colonists, want to live there and continue there, the original PLO charter said you are welcome to remain among us as citizens, but you cannot come here as colonists and take our land and subjugate us and expel us and kill us and think we're not going to resist you. Well, that's a basic elementary democratic premise.
Yeah.
We don't say that the French colons in North Africa who went there in 1830 had the right to hold the land and the property and the cities and the wealth of North Africa, of either Algeria or Morocco or Tunisia or Libya. We didn't say to the Algerians, oh, you can't revolt against French colonialism in North Africa. You can't revolt in Indochina against Japanese and French colonial rule. Oh, no. First, you have to allow exclusive Japanese or French colonial control over your principal cities and remain in ownership of all the land. Then, if you do that, you can be in some little Bantustan duchy with no rights and with under military subjugation. Then you can have that form of fake autonomy. Nobody said that. Except apologists for colonialism and imperialism. So what's going on in Gaza and in the West Bank? What is the West Bank? It's 17% of Palestine. 17% is the West Bank.
Yep.
And 45% of it has already been confiscated by the Zionists. And 89% of all its water and its principal cities. And the population is confined to little pockets surrounded by military roads controlled by the Israelis, with all communicating network of roads under Israeli military control. And that's supposed to be the roadmap, and that's supposed to be the Oslo agreements, and that's to be what they call some form of Palestinian autonomy. That's just to make them a slave population for cheap labor for the Zionists until the Zionists get ready to expel them to Jordan or to Iraq, which is their project. All wings of the Zionist movement, whether it's the Labor Party or the Likud, have as their project the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The Judaization of the land is what it's called. That's what it means to seize East Jerusalem. That's what it means to wipe out the Kasbah and Nablus, which is 1,000 years old, which is what they did last year. They reduced it to rubble. This is a genocidal project in Palestine. It has been from its inception. And the Palestinian resistance to colonial occupation and to removal from the land has been continuous for over 120 years now. It's taken every form, from civil disobedience, from hunger strikes, from passive resistance, to armed resistance, to formation of political parties. And every wing of the Palestinian movement, until the Islamic fundamentalists, who were funded by the Zionists from the beginning, every wing of the Palestinian movement had said to the made an appeal to the settler population, and the appeal to the settler population was, join us. Why you are locked in the ultimate ghetto here? You're in a sea of Arab peoples who are oppressed. 150 million Arab peoples who are seething in anger against these puppet regimes and these colonial masters now, who visit war upon war of subjugation upon them. And you want to be tied to an apartheid-like regime that's dependent upon the permanent subjugation of the Arab masses? Talk about the ultimate ghetto. Talk about the ultimate insecurity.
Right.
Yeah? The Jews of Palestine, after all, you have to remember that the irony of it is that the indigenous Palestinian Jews were totally integrated within Palestinian society. They were not the persecutor discriminated in Palestine. In fact, they weren't persecutor discriminated in the Arab East until the formation of the Zionist state. Up to then, for example, in Iraq, the Jews of Iraq were totally, they were the main administrators of the court. They were in positions of decisive importance in commerce all over Iraq. They were the professionals. They were in commerce in the towns and in the bazaars. There is no discrimination against Jews in Iraq. Right after the formation of the Israeli state, the Israeli intelligence services, this is well documented, proceeded to blow up synagogues across Iraq to create a panic and hysteria amongst Iraqi Jews. Well, here's the problem. They succeeded in stampeding Iraqi Jews into leaving Iraq when they began this. And there's the leader of the Iraqi Jews who wound up in Israel, Naim Gilati, who formed actually the Black Panthers amongst the what are called the Sephardim or the Mizrahi or the Oriental Jews. Naim Gilati wrote a book on Ben Gurion's wars and documented what happened to the Jews in Iraq and the Mossad role in all of this. This is well established. So what happened to the Oriental Jews, who are now almost 68% of the Jewish population in Israel or Palestine? The Oriental Jews have 3% of the professional and civil service jobs, and they're 1% of the university graduates, and they're almost 70% of the population. Because what do you think a Yemeni Jew looks like? A Yemeni Jew looks like Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Right.
He has the wedding customs and the eating habits and the mores of Muslim Yemenis, because an Oriental Jew is an Arab who happens to have Jewish religious convictions. You can't tell the difference between a Yemeni Christian and a Yemeni Muslim and a Yemeni Jew. They're Arabs who are of Jewish religious persuasion. So they're treated one quarter step above the condition of the Palestinians themselves in Israel. Israel discriminates and persecutes its own Arab-Jewish population ruthlessly and relentlessly. I mean, they live in slums and ghettos, and they're cheap labor in the colonial settler state of Israel. So what we see unfolding in Gaza and in the West Bank is a little continuation of this permanent subjugation of the Palestinian people. And I don't even want to begin. Maya and I did a book called Prisoners of Israel, based upon the Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of them have passed through Israeli prisons under conditions of total torture. I mean, the most barbaric torture that a fiendish mind can dream up. Buried alive, every atrocity that can be cited from Abu Ghraib. I mean, the Sunday London Times did a six-part series on it. Amnesty International, human rights organizations, our own book, Prisoners of Israel, is an agonizing documentation of these Palace of the Damned-like dungeons in which the Palestinian youth and intelligentsia and independence fighters have been condemned over these 48. I mean, it's a horror. So the nature of what is happening in Palestine right now in Gaza, where the people of Gaza, they're concentrated in such an enormous mass in such a tiny little area without any of the infrastructure of survival. Talk about your ultimate ghetto. And as I say, in the Palestinian refugee camps, because what happened to the population that was driven out? The population that was driven out and the population that was driven out of their homes and towns and villages into what was then part of Jordan, or control the Palestine of the West Bank, they're in camps, refugee camps that are miserable. We've lived in the camps of Jabalia and the beach camp in Gaza and Dehesi and Balata in near Bethlehem and Nablus, respectively, the great refugee camps near Hebron and Jericho and so on. I mean, these are the the most unspeakable. I mean, raw sewage, no potable water, everything you can imagine that's imposed upon these people, and the irony of all this is that in spite of all this unspeakable oppression, the first thing on the mind of every Palestinian family is to gather together whatever resources they can, get their children out and educated. The percentage of Palestinian youth who have been educated as engineers and doctors and lawyers in the Arab world through being sent out to study, they have a higher ratio of educated youth than the Zionist Jews themselves. The Palestinian diaspora.
Well, let me ask you this. Are they going to leave any Palestinians alive when they finish? Or is this a whole crazy program that these...
Let me tell you something. They've done this in predation after predation. To give you to answer your question, Lenny, in 1982, first of all, you have to understand that in 47 and 48, the Zionists occupied the half of Lebanon, right up to the Litani River. Because it was then a French colony, in essence, the French, who had been giving them arms and jets along with the Americans, cut them off until they pulled back from the Litani River. So what did they do? They set up these in Lebanon, they looked for some fascist elements. There was a fascist movement in Lebanon called the Falange, based upon Generalissimo Francisco Franco's fascist party, the Falange. And so the Zionists armed and financed the Maronites, the Catholic minority in Lebanon, and their particularly their right-wing proto-fascist party, the Falange, to instigate civil war in Lebanon, which the Zionists then used as an opportunity to then continually invade. The largest refugee camp of Palestinians in Lebanon was in Ain el Helwe, which means in Arabic sweet spring, and it's located outside of Sidon, the second largest city in Lebanon. In 1982, the Zionists, Sharon and Begin, had a plan, which was to seize Lebanon and to not just crush the Palestinians in the camps, but to reduce them from 500,000 to 50,000 people. That was their formal project. They started, and they called it the Peace in the Galilee. Yeah? Talk about your 1984. What do you think, where were the inhabitants of the Galilee, the real inhabitants of the Galilee? Were in Ain el Helwe and in Rashidiya, in the Palestinian refugee camps. The people who had been massacred and driven out of Galilee, the survivors, they settled in the tent camps outside of Sidon, in Ain el Helwe, sweet spring. Only after 15 years of living in tents did the Lebanese government allow them to even use cinder block. They weren't allowed employment. The only way they were able to survive was because of the Palestine Liberation Organization was providing people with food and with electricity and with work. And the Zionists took Ain el-Helwa as a grid. They bombed it for 10 days and 10 nights, saturation bombing. They divided it into quadrants. They saturation bombed 10 days and 10 nights at Ain el-Helwa. Maya and I were there. We were living in Ain el-Helwa. Then from the sea and from the mountains, 10 days and 10 nights of non-stop artillery bombardment in this small place. At that time there were 80,000 inhabitants in Ain el-Helwa. Then they came in with the army and with the bulldozers, and they reduced everything to rubble. And the Palestinians, civilians who were in shelters, they covered over those shelters and buried them alive. In Ain el-Helwa, the mass graves were of such magnitude that the body fluids created rivulets, and the water or the body fluids now began to run as a little river, and the International Committee of the Red Cross headquarters outside of Ain el-Helwa in Sidon was in the path of the rivulets, of the body fluids of those buried in the mass graves. So the ICRC moved its building. Not even a mention in any of the Red Cross reports of the mass graves and of the massacre in Ain el-Helwa. We have documented that, and beyond that, this was the process in Rashidiya that was in Elbas, in all the camps. And then when they brought the fascist militia leader Bashir Gemayel into nominal power in Beirut, he was summoned like a schoolboy to Haifa by Begin and Sharon, and he was instructed to hand over the south of Lebanon. Well, Bashir Gemayel was hoping to extend his nominal rule over the country of Lebanon, and he couldn't get Saudi investment unless he did. So he said to Begin and to Sharon, "I can't do that. You have to give me time." He went back to Beirut and he said to Saab Salem, who was the leader of the Sunni Muslims in Beirut, "I'm in trouble." And these were bitter
really?
Political opponents. And Saab Salem said to Bashir, "You don't know the half of it." Within 10 days of that, Bashir Gemayel was assassinated in a very sophisticated delayed bomb explosion. Immediately, the Zionists said, "Oh, the Palestinians did it. The Palestinians killed Bashir Gemayel."
Right.
Which was the pretext then for what? They surrounded they had 500 tanks surrounding Beirut. They saturation bombed Beirut, destroyed, cut it off from all electricity and from all water and from all food. We were living in West Beirut in Hamra and Fahani in the west of Beirut at the time. And then they proceeded to bring in these killer squads led by Israeli officers into the Palestinian camps of Sabra and Shatila and Burj al-Barajni.
Uh-huh.
And they began with knives and machetes to slaughter the population. 3,500 people were butchered in this way in Sabra and Shatila. Maya and I were actually trying to get into Sabra and Shatila, where we had many friends during the siege. We were walking through bombed out buildings and hiding as the Israeli patrols moved on, and then we made our way, not knowing what we were going to find. We got into the north of Sabra, and there was just bodies everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Mutilated bodies. We, as we were crying, we photographed them. We took, Maya was a professional filmmaker. We had slides of the butchery everywhere. We hid. We have pictures of the Israeli units in Sabra and Shatila. We have pictures of the Israeli tanks in Sabra and Shatila. We have pictures of the killer militia. The slides called the War in Lebanon, an Inside View, which we showed at the United, when we came out to the UN. We had a press conference at the UN. There were over 150 television and camera journalists there as we showed this, what happened in Sabra and Shatila and in Ain El Helwe. And it was on the front page of Le Monde, and not a word in a single newspaper in the United States of what happened. In Beirut, This is what the Zionist occupiers did in Beirut. I'm not even going to talk about the what happened to large sections of the population. As Eli Hobeika, who was the CIA's man, that if you want to find out what happened to the Palestinians, you have to dig a subway under Beirut.
Yeah.
They went into the homes of the intelligentsia in Beirut, which is a very cosmopolitan and sophisticated city. I'm talking now about the professors at the American University of Beirut. I'm talking about the managers and directors of the museums and of first of all, they went into all the museums and they looted them and they threw shit on all the walls and on the tapestries. And then they went into the homes of the university president and the professors, and they took their furnishings, they took their paintings, they took their books. They said, "We are the people of the book. If you want to read these, you have to come to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem." And they brought units of soldiers into the homes of these people, and they shat all over these and threw shit on the walls and this has been documented, and we had chapter and verse, not only from the eyewitnesses but photographs, and we spent 6 weeks trying to get a bourgeois newspaper. Finally, Jonathan Randall actually ran this story in the Washington Post. The impact on the Lebanese population of the utter disdain and contempt and racist abuse, the treatment of that population by this occupying army has been more searing and more enraging than the loss of life itself. Because it's a degradation by design. That's the nature of this Zionist movement. That's why the anti-Zionist Jews, like the leading theologian Yeshua Leibovitz, calls them Judeo-Nazis.
Oh, that's a good term.
That's the designation of Israel Shahak, who is the survivor of Maidanek, who was the head of the Israeli human rights organization. Called them Judeo-Nazis. The ironic thing about this is that the Orthodox Jews of Jerusalem, the Naturei Karta, for example, they are anti-Zionist.
Right.
Yeah, the Naturei Karta, which is a large sector of West Jerusalem, the Orthodox Jews consider that that Zionism is a desecration because they're out of religious conviction. There should be no Jewish colonization of Palestine until the Messiah returns. But the Naturei Karta were in the councils of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The representative, one of the main spokespeople for the PLO in Paris, was Ilan Halevi, who was an Oriental Jew. Huh? Yeah, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, George Habash.
Uh-huh.
There's a Christian. The leader of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Naif Hawatne, is a Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah. The Palestinian movement had nothing to do with interest in who's a Muslim, who's a Christian. Leading the population of Ramallah is overwhelmingly Christian. They voted 90% for Hamas. Why? Because Hamas says the Zionist state is illegitimate. That we want a unified Palestine for the people of Palestine. Jews, they can stay as citizens. When the French in Algeria, the French in Morocco, the French in Tunisia, if they've lived there for generations, they want to remain. Well, of course they should remain as citizens with equal rights. But that's not to say, if you and I want to go to Belgium tomorrow, we should have the ability to immigrate to Belgium and become citizens. But if we say, well, Europe has 3 million square miles, so what's a little piece of Belgium? What's Belgium? We'll take over Belgium, we'll colonize it, and we'll expel its population. I think the Belgians might have something a little different in mind. What is this double standard that applies when it comes to the question of Palestine, this indecent exceptionalism? So what's unfolding in Gaza and in the West Bank today with this all-out onslaught on the population, so what else is new?
Yeah.
That's what they had been planning and continue to plan under the cover of war. Their project is to expel this population or to create a living hell so that people can't survive and they'll leave through attrition.
Uh-huh.
That's the project. I mean the Zionist colony in Palestine cannot be reconciled with the survival of this population. And any part of that Palestinian movement that accepts the legitimacy of the Israeli state is simply converting itself into its pass-through instruments. They cannot address the most elementary needs of the population through this capitulation. And as I say, the fate of the Jewish inhabitants, the settler population of Israel and Palestine, the fate of the Jews is to be part of a continuous garrison state, to be made apologists and collaborators in a barbarous torment of an oppressed people. It's the moral degeneracy of being associated with, like the Germans under Hitler. That's the same fate that was before those Germans who were collaborators with the Nazis. They were put in the position of having to become oppressors of the most bestial kind. And to earn the enmity of all the surrounding populations. What kind of future is that for these people? So the only answer for the Jews of Palestine is to be in opposition to a colonial settler state and to demand a democratic polity in that society, a democratic and secular society where rights do not depend on ethnicity or religious affiliation. It's so basic. It's an 18th century idea. And it is an irony that it was one of the predicates, and we should talk a moment about this, Lenny, because...
we've got time. Let's talk about it.
Today is the 4th of July, right?
Yep.
It's the 230th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which was a document that initiated a revolution against colonialism and despotism, and it inspired people. Without whatever the limitations, it was basically the people who led that revolution were inspired by the Enlightenment and concepts of democratic entitlement. You know how radical it was to suggest that people should have the right to rule themselves, not based on property ownership or on or family descent or on connection to some landed aristocratic elite, that people had were equal in their entitlement and they were entitled to rule over themselves. This was to the privileged an absurd idea.
Right.
That illiterate and people who had no judgment and no education should be entitled to make decisions, that they should have the control over the affairs of state. What a ludicrous idea. What a dangerous idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was it that the Declaration of Independence, which was imbued with the ideals of the Enlightenment and abhorred ignorance and exploitation and inequality, what is it that they said? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers solely from the consent of the governed. And then whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, what would happen if such a document were presented to the United States Congress today? Would it would it escape a veto, or would it, or those who presented it be put in jail? Well, the entire content of the policies and actions of the ruling class in the United States is a repudiation of the revolutionary ideals and principles and documents that formed this country in 1776.
Well, a lot of people might say that letting people rule themselves will lead to crazy people getting into power and doing silly things and crazy things, and that's what we have now with George Bush.
Yeah, but George Bush does not come to power because of the presence of democratic institutions in the United States. George Bush comes to power because 1% of the population owns 95% of the total wealth. George Bush comes to power because the political process is owned by a privileged, autocratic, and oligarchical elite. And in fact, what did they charge the British king with? He has affected to render the military independent and superior to the civil power.
Exactly.
What? Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it sure
what
does.
What does it accuse the British monarch of doing? Quartering large bodies of armed troops among us and protecting them from punishment for murders should they commit them on inhabitants.
Oh,
is that what we see in Iraq?
Yeah.
He said, what does the document say about the King George? He's plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. How many countries has this ruling class done that to?
Yeah.
At this time, he is transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. That's what they were saying about King George. How does that describe the behavior of American imperialism? Plunder, death, desolation, tyranny, cruelty, perfidy. Who does that apply to today?
Yeah.
So 230 years after this revolution against British colonialism, who is standing in the shoes and in the position of King George today? And then what does the British monarchy get charged with in the Declaration of Independence? Depriving us of the benefits of trial by jury, and transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. What is rendition and imprisoned in Guantanamo and in Abu Ghraib? Huh? What are the other charges against King George in the Declaration of Independence? that he has claimed the right to indefinitely detain without trial or charges those whom it decrees as enemies. While, you know, well, what is it that the extraordinary rendition represents today?
Yeah.
There is a, and by the way, in the New York Times, a very instructive column yesterday by Professor Edwin Burroughs of Brooklyn College, who calls attention to the fate of American colonists who were imprisoned by the British in New York City at the time of the Revolution. 12,000 of them died due to the conditions of their confinement. They were packed in the makeshift prisons in public and private buildings and on broken down ships in New York Harbor without adequate food or water or any semblance of sanitation. And he says the brutalization of the American insurgents was justified by the British monarchy on the grounds that they, quote, were not soldiers but rebels, and defining them as prisoners of war would amount to de facto recognition of American independence, unquote. Well, what is it that they talk about when they speak of enemy combatants
today
who are not entitled to the Geneva Convention or to trial to be represented or to due process or to have a presumption of innocence? Then, in regard to the fate of American prisoners, he says that the first treaty signed in 1785 between the newly independent United States and Prussia prescribed humane treatment of prisoners of war. This is the precursor of the Geneva Convention. And then Burroughs states in this article in the New York Times that even if such a treaty had been in effect earlier, it wouldn't have saved the American prisoners, because Britain was the world superpower in those days, as the United States is now, and if King George didn't want to treat the rebel prisoners humanely, only principle and conscience stood in the way. Now, it doesn't take a soothsayer to see the analogy between King George
and the current
George when it comes to enemy combatants and overriding the Geneva Conventions and eliminating due process. No, the revolutionary founders of the United States set out to reverse these oppressive and autocratic and arbitrary violations of people's ability to survive. And these democratic rights that emerged as a result of that revolution are now being suborned and subordinated to massive spying operations against the entire public of the United States, the virtual shredding of the Bill of Rights and the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The other demand of the Declaration of Independence is that there should be unlimited rights of media to communicate and to expose the crimes of government. And indeed now members of Congress are calling for the trial of the editors of the New York Times and Los Angeles Times for treason because they've exposed the spying on the American public.
Right.
So what we're dealing with here is a regime that on the basis of the Declaration of Independence and on the basis of the founding of this republic, and the basis of the independence that was established in 1776, on the basis of all the documents and of all the arguments and of the movement of its leadership itself, on the basis of that, there should be a revolutionary overthrow of the government of the United States, and these tyrannical figures should be put on trial for treason and removed from office and from power by any and all means necessary. The predicate of that revolution, and that Declaration of Independence 230 years ago, is very clear and very straightforward. These people can't be contained, they can't be reformed, they can't be changed, and they cannot be persuaded. They have to be removed. They have to be removed by any and all means necessary, and they have to be overthrown and replaced by a revolutionary movement of transformation, and we should be basing ourselves upon the Declaration of Independence And upon the declaration of those revolutionaries of 1776, and upon the declaration of Thomas Jefferson when he said, and this is my mantra, God forbid we should ever be 20 years without a revolution. The blood of tyrants is democracy's natural manure.
Yeah.
That's the legacy of 1776.
Yeah.
And that's the entitlement to which everybody in this society should be responding now more than ever.
Well, certainly, Ralph, there's been a long train of usurpations and, a long train of abuses and usurpations, is what the Declaration of Independence says, and there certainly has been, and therefore it's the legal responsibility to overthrow the government, and if you don't overthrow the existing government, you're breaking the law.
Yes. Now, the process through which these people will be removed, is one of mass mobilization. Violence is concentrated in the hands of the rulers. No rational person embraces it lightly. But we have the right to self-defense. And when our rights are taken from us, and when we're assaulted by an arbitrary authority, and where we're imprisoned without trial and disappeared without any entitlement to knowledge as to what has been the fate of the person taken, then we have the right to resist that. That's a basic right. That's what the democratic entitlement of the Declaration of Independence affirms. And that's the predicate for the removal of this ruling class from power in the United States and for the transformation of our societies. The revolutionary entitlement of the population, which was enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and is actually made supposedly the law of the land through the Constitution of the United States. All of those protections of the Constitution, the first 10 amendments to which the Bill of Rights were the result of a second revolution in the United States, the Whiskey Rebellion. There was an uprising of the population over the absence of those rights being incorporated in the Constitution, and the people who were the landowners and others who were concentrating power in their hands were compelled by the Whiskey Rebellion to enshrine those rights in the first 10 amendments to the American Constitution. And the Fourth Amendment, which is the right against seizure and the entitlement to due process, is now been repudiated by the Supreme Court of the United States, which ruled that the police in the United States can enter your house without knocking, can seize what's in it without justification, and that the authority for that resides solely in the discretion of the executive or the president of the United States. It is precisely to remove that arbitrary and authority of King George that the revolutionary movement in the United States was undertaken, and that the Declaration of Independence was written. That was its reasoning. That was its motivation, and that was its intent to guarantee that should those kinds of actions ever occur again, that the people would rise up in a similar way and reclaim their rights. That's our responsibility. It's not a question there, as I like to say, it's not the evil that is new or the crisis that has changed. It's that every generation is confronted by the same responsibilities and challenges to defend our rights, to expand those rights, and to resist arbitrary and brutal authority with its lies and its connivances and its 9/11s and its false flag operations.
Yeah.
Which are based upon the hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Are based upon precisely that category of abuse that is adumbrated in the Declaration of Independence of 1776.
Well, Ralph, it's been a real pleasure and an honor on July 4th, the American Independence Day, to get a great wrap-up and review of the events and put it into this great historical context, which you've done. Once again, if our friend and colleague Sherman Skolnick were here, He would say, it's been a pleasure to have you bring your treasury of wisdom and knowledge to us, and once again you've demonstrated that, and it's just been wonderful. I think that we'll just wrap it up there, and thanks so much for your wrap up, Ralph.
And we started by describing and discussing the fate of the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
I would like to just say this in conclusion,
yep.
By the way. If ever a people should understand and know from experience what it means to be persecuted, and what it means to be deprived of all rights, and what it means to be subjugated to massacre, you'd think it would be the Jews after their experience and their history of such treatment in Catholic and Christian Europe. So, if ever there is a people that should identify with the Palestinian population and what they have been that to which they've been subjected, it ought to be the Jews. And it seems to me ironic that the Jews, who have such a legacy of persecution, and particularly in concluding about that, we didn't have an opportunity to discuss the fact that I mentioned that the Zionist movement had collaborated with the Tsar and with the most repressive and anti-Semitic regimes and reactionary regimes of the day. They also collaborated with Mussolini, the leader of the Zionist youth, Beitar. Begin wore the black shirt and gave the fascist salute.
Uh-huh.
Throughout the 1930s, both labor Zionists and revisionist Zionists of Jabotinsky collaborated with the Nazis. They brought Eichmann to Palestine in 1936. They brought Baron von Mildenstein, the head of the SS, to Palestine for 6 months. And he wrote a 12-part series in the Nazi newspaper called Der Angriff, which means the assault, praising Zionism. The Nazis actually made a medallion with the Star of David on one side and the swastika on the other,
uh-huh.
To honor the Zionists. Yeah. As late as 1940, the movement of Yitzhak Shamir formed a military pact with the Wehrmacht. It was called the Ankara document because the military pact document was found in the German embassy in Turkey in Ankara in 1945. The Zionist movement collaborated with the Nazis. They colluded with the Nazis because they wanted the Jews only as colonists. They opposed any rescue for the European Jews. They opposed any emigration for the victims of Nazism. They opposed changing the immigration quotas in Canada and the United States and in Britain and Australia. They said explicitly, Katznilson and Ben Gurion, better that they should all be gone than they should leave for Europe, because then the Judaization of the land in Palestine will be off the agenda. Yeah, the Zionists wrapped themselves in the collective shroud of the 6 million victims of the Holocaust. The irony of it all is that when the acid test of the fate of the Jews was at stake, the Zionists were on the side of their persecutors. In 1944, the Zionist leadership made a deal with Adolf Eichmann. They would cooperate in the extermination of the Hungarian Jews in exchange for Zionist leaders being transported out to Palestine. A handful of Zionist figures, and then the Zionists formed the Judenrat, the Jewish councils that colluded with the Nazis, that kept secret the plans of extermination. The whole fate of the Hungarian Jews was through collusion between the Zionist leadership and Adolf Eichmann. This, even the Israeli Supreme Court found that to be the case when one of the Hungarian Jewish survivors in Israel saw the people who actually implemented that pact with Eichmann,
uh-huh.
and accused them, and the Ben Gurion government panicked. And they first they pulled off an assassination of the person who was accused, and the accuser continued, and so the Israeli government tried to sue him, and it went to the Supreme Court of Israel, and he brought all the documentation, and the Supreme Court had ruled that in fact the Zionist leadership had sacrificed the mass of Hungarian Jewry. Through its dealings with Eichmann, this is a part of the documented record of the role of the Zionist government. But they forever invoke the Holocaust as a justification for their visiting the same kind of fate upon the Palestinian people. So the hidden history of Zionism, Lenny, it's critical for our understanding that we. Demystify the Israeli state and the Zionist movement and expose it for what it is, because it has proven itself not only to be the destroyer of the Palestinian people, but it is the betrayer of the Jews themselves, particularly at their time of need. The last book of Vladimir Jabotinsky, called the Jewish War Front, paradoxically, which the last book he wrote, he says in that book that the fate of the Jews now in Europe and in Germany gives us a tremendous opportunity, he says, to do the same thing in Palestine, because he says Herr Hitler has made population transfer rather popular and legitimate. Yeah. So what does he draw, what conclusion do the Zionist leaders draw from the destruction of European Jewry? Now we have the license to do the same thing to the Palestinians, because the Germans have got away with it and they've done it, so let us do the same. If anything reveals the utter moral bankruptcy and corruption of Zionist ideology and Zionist thinking, well, they've assimilated Jew hatred and anti-Semitism and made it into their own ideology. That's the dirty secret of Zionism. The dirty secret of Zionism is its relationship to the Jews, not just its persecution of the Palestinian people. The persecution of the Palestinian people by now is before the eyes of everyone, but its betrayal of the Jews themselves is not something that is so well understood. So yeah. And it's not unlike the role of the ruling class in relation to the democratic rights of the population of North America, and its own relationship to that revolutionary movement that was the birth and the beginning of the country that they have usurped. Yes. So part of the importance of the broadcasting you do and with Cloak and Dagger is to remove the veil of deception and to expose the lies and to allow people to see the the nature of oppression and what it is that the official propaganda of the oppressor state seeks to impose upon us and to enslave our minds in order to preserve that rule. It took a revolution to undo this in the 18th century. It's going to take a revolution to undo it in the 21st century as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so many people of the Jewish persuasion are just useful fools of this whole Zionist operation, which they believe is a peaceful, peace-loving operation.
Well, you know, the irony of that, of course, is that Zionism was an absolutely marginal movement amongst the Jews. I mean, Jews in Europe had vanishingly little interest in the colonizing lunacies of the Zionists. It's only with the backing of U.S. imperialism and the legitimizing of the Israeli state that Jews have been induced to identify with Israel and to associate the Israeli state with the survivors and the remnant of the Holocaust. The Holocaust has been, you know, there's one of the most insidious of the perpetrators of this is Eli Wiesel. We call him Eli
Wiesel.
And you know, the Hebrew word for Holocaust is Shoah, right? So they say in Israel, there's no business like Shoah business.
Oh, really?
Because the Eli Wiesels and these people have made an industry out of the Holocaust, and forever wrapping themselves in the shroud, as I say, of the victims of the Holocaust. Shoah, Shoah, Shoah. But Shoah, Shoah, Shoah is all for Shoah. And they not only deploy the fate of the Jews in Europe as a rationalization for what they do to the Palestinian people, but they conceal their own relationship, that of the Zionist movement and Zionist leadership, to the Holocaust itself. So if the Jews can be conned into the acceptance of the Zionist movement, which was the movement of collaborators with Nazism in Germany and not just during the Holocaust, you know, right after World War II, the Jew killers were in strong relationship to the Israeli state, like Kurt Becker, who was the head of the Waffen-SS units and known as the worst of the butchers of European Jewry. The Zionists intervened to make sure that he wasn't tried at Nuremberg, and they continued to be in business with him right after he was installed in positions of authority in post-war Germany. Of course, the Central Intelligence Agency took all of the leaders of the SS and incorporated them into the OSS, and incorporated them into the CIA.
Yeah.
The heads of NATO, Speidel and Heusinger,
yeah,
were the heads of the Hitler's Wehrmacht general staff.
Yeah.
They just made them into the heads of NATO and put the they had Operation Paperclip, in which they brought all the Nazis. I'm talking about not just Nazi sympathizers. I'm talking about the death camp people. I mean, people, Mengele and Barbie and all of them, CIA and Mossad supported after the Second World War. That's the truth that the dirty truth, the explosive truth that the Jews who are Zionists don't understand. And of course, you know, when I lecture all over the place on the subject, and the hidden history of Zionism has been translated into many, many, many languages, the Zionists are unable to deal with it. They try to prevent the book from being read, but they dare not. I mean, they can't. They dare not debate me on the subject or any other anti-Zionist because they can't deal with the evidence. They don't know the evidence, and when they're confronted by it, they're dumbstruck.
Yeah.
I've had this happen over and over again at universities where Zionist hecklers or Zionist this or that try to I engage them with the evidence, and they're
shocked.
They have nothing to say. They have nothing they can say.
Absolutely. Ralph, this started to come out with the book Perfidy, right? And then
Ben Hecht, yes. That's Ben. Well, Ben Hecht was a screenwriter and a right-wing Zionist. And he didn't know. What happened with Ben Hecht is he read about Kastner. Kastner was the Ben-Gurion emissary who made the deal with Adolf Eichmann. And when he read the documentation, particularly in the lawsuit before the Supreme Court, he was so traumatized that he broke with his Zionist beliefs, and he wrote the book Perfidy. But I can tell you, Lenny, that the people who bear the most credit and responsibility for exposing all this are Akiva Orr and Moshe Makover, who were the mathematicians and physicists in Israel who formed the Marxist organization, the Trotskyist organization called Matzpen, which means compass in Hebrew. And when Aki, who's a dear friend, he's still in close touch with Akiva, when Akiva was a student in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, he heard about the evidence about Kastner from the people who exposed him, and he went and got all the documentation, and they began to publish this in Matzpen. And it's through that that the knowledge of the fate of the Hungarian Jews became widely known, and that's when Ben Hecht wrote his book, Perfidy. They actually tried to do a play in London based upon the documents pertaining to this, and it was removed from the London stage. It was booked, and it was the theater was shut down. This happened about 12 years ago. One of the few instances in which that kind of censorship was actually formally imposed,
right,
in Great Britain.
Well, listen,
but yes, the fate of the Hungarian Jews was a exposure of what happened in the Dr. Rudolf Kastner of the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee in Budapest signing a secret pact with Eichmann to, quote, settle the Jewish question in Hungary. This was in 1944, and the pact sealed the fate of 800,000 Jews. The survivor who exposed it was Machiel Greenwald, who denounced Kastner as a Nazi collaborator whose, quote, deeds in Budapest cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Jews. And then Greenwald was sued by the Israeli government, whose leaders had drawn up the Kastner Pact, and this is what the Israeli court concluded. The sacrifice of the majority of Jews in order to rescue the Zionist prominence was the basic element in the agreement between Kastner and the Nazis. The agreement fixed the division of the nation into two unequal camps, a tiny fragment of prominent Zionists, whom the Nazis promised Kastner, and the great majority of Hungarian Jews, who the Nazis designated for death, unquote. That's the court ruling, and the court declared that the imperative condition of the pact was neither Kastner nor the Zionist leaders would interfere in the actions of the Nazis against the Hungarian Jews. They were obligated not only to eschew interference, but they agreed that they would not, in the words of the Israeli court, hamper them in the extermination. Collaboration between the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee and the extermination of the Jews, I'm still quoting from the court decision, was solidified in Budapest and Vienna. Kastner's duties were part and parcel of the SS. In addition to his extermination department and looting department, the Nazi SS opened a rescue department headed by Kastner. Now, Kastner also intervened to save SS General Kurt Becker from being tried for war crimes. Becker was one of the leading negotiators of the deal with the Zionists in 1944. He was also the SS commandant and major in Poland, a member of the Death Corps, quote, that worked around the clock killing Jews, unquote. Quote, Becker distinguished himself as the premium Jew slaughterer in Poland and Russia, unquote. He was appointed the commissar of all Nazi concentration camps by Heinrich Himmler. What happened to him? He became president of many corporations. He headed up the sale of wheat and goods to Israel. His corporation, the Kolon Handel Gesellschaft, did exclusive and extensive business with the Israeli government. Yeah? and he became a principal collaborator with the Israeli state, just as he had been in the extermination of the Hungarian Jews. So that's the perfidy, that's the record of which Hecht wrote in such utter shock. That's, by the way, what does happen to many Jews when they are confronted by this evidence. First of all, it's very hard for most Jews who've identified with the Israeli state to assimilate this information. It's too disturbing and too shocking. But particularly amongst youth who have now seen for year after year after year the crimes visited upon the Palestinian people, they are much more open to this reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Terrific. Well, we're going to call it there, and we'll certainly look forward to your next briefing. It's just been great. This is a special extended version for the July 4th, and it's certainly great, Ralph, having you theme us in and get us back in touch with what's really going on. And scrape the bullshit off the truth, because there certainly was a lot of bullshit on the truth.
I'm afraid so. Thank you, Lenny.
We'll look forward to your report again next week.